Welcome, friends, to another edition of Economic Update. I'm your host, Richard Wolff. Been an economics professor all of my adult life, and I'm having a wonderful time producing every week this program about the incomes, the debts, the jobs, the financial futures of our kids, to try to make sense of what's happening in the larger economy, and to do so without the taboos and without the status quo reproduction that characterizes the few other folks on the media who talk about economics in any kind of consistent way. We also maintain websites and other kinds of supports for this program, and a little bit later in the program, I'll be telling you about those. Let's jump right in, though, catching up with the week's events in Economic Update. I want to start where we left off last week by telling you about a problem that is affecting many of our large cities and to which a new answer has to be found. And I want to celebrate a little bit an unusual politician, David Salaverry in San Francisco, who's actually moving in that direction. Here's the issue. We have in most cities a taxi service, taxis that provide personal transport to individuals under a whole host of circumstances. And in most cities, the taxi business is regulated to make sure that the car you're using, if you command a taxi, is safe, that the car has been inspected, that the driver has been qualified, that insurance is in place, so that in short, it's the safe, efficient ride that you want. And over the years, in order to provide a quality service, these regulatory commissions governing the taxi industry have also been receptive to the notion that if you want good taxi service, you have to pay a decent wage, often with the prodding of unionizing efforts by the taxi drivers. This was finally put into place. So you have a taxi system, which in most cases provides a decent and safe ride and provides not a very luxurious, but nonetheless a basic income for the driver. Not surprisingly, when you have a situation like this, there are always new capitalists who see an opportunity. In the case of the taxi industry, we have the most famous, the Uber car company, but we also have a couple of others. One is called Lyft, L-Y-F-T, and the other one is called Sidecar. These are all new entrants into this market, offering to provide the public usually with a cheaper ride than they can get with a cab, and therefore muscling in on the taxi business. And in an interesting twist, over recent years, as this has developed, they have referred to what they're doing as providing a quote-unquote shared economy. Now, the idea is to put a very nice spin on a very old story. The nice spin is, look, here are all these part-time and other folks driving their own cars, coordinated by a sophisticated computer arrangement, who will give you a lift and charge you less, at least in some circumstances, than you would have to pay for a cab. Everybody is, here we go, sharing their car. Well, the truth of the matter is a little less cute. The truth of the matter is that the way these car companies muscle in and undercut the cab is by not checking into their drivers anywhere near so carefully, not maintaining the standards of function of the mechanical parts of the automobile, playing a little loose with the insurance, sometimes more, sometimes less, and so on. They're providing a cheaper ride because they pay their workers less in the end, and they cut corners on other parts. Now, every time this happens, we have sort of two sides to the economic coin. On the one hand, and to some degree, a cheaper ride is provided. The price of the product goes down, and that benefits the people who buy that product. On the other hand, the well-being and usually the income of a traditional group of workers, in this case taxi drivers, is also depressed as they lose business and their incomes suffer. The impact on the economy depends on all of the consequences of a falling price on the one hand and a falling income of a group of workers on the other. The same is played out in every other area of business. For example, if you go back, say, to the meat business or to the drug business, we had companies establishing a reasonable product, paying their workers a reasonable amount, and in come a group of new capitalist hustlers who offer a cheaper price, cheaper meat, cheaper drugs, whatever the product. And they get away with it by paying workers less, going to a non-union workforce, cutting corners here and there. And guess what? Over a period of time, they may win out. Cheaper products may be able to push the old producers out of business, lowering their incomes, firing their workers, and so on. But eventually, guess what? If you lower the income of a large group of workers, that has negative effects on the income and on the economy as a whole. Meanwhile, the lower price pressures the companies that are producing at the lower price to do more of the corner cutting, more of the squeezing the wages of their workers, who then begin to fight back, who begin to raise up the standard of their living. That causes those companies to raise the price again, and we work our way back to the same situation we had in the beginning, waiting for a new crop of hustlers to come in and take us through this crazy arrangement again. Look, this is a problem. Is there a way that you could stop this repeated cycle, which often causes great harm to the workers whose jobs are hurt, and causes eventually great harm to the public that is taking risks it only slowly becomes aware of, turning to the cheaper product of the more cheaply producing new capitalist entrants into the market? Well, the answer, long way of going about it, the answer is yes. And this fellow, David Salivary in San Francisco, has come up in the case of the taxi business and the private car business with an interesting solution. Why don't we make taxis everywhere run as a public service with a worker co-op? Get the cab and drivers together, both the old taxi drivers and the new entrants that use their own car in some sharing system, if you want to use that language, but make them part of a cooperative of workers who work under the direct either ownership or at least supervision of the community. They don't have to provide profits to a private company because they are a cooperative of workers. All they need to do is provide safe, reliable service and to pay a decent living wage to the drivers, whether they be old taxi-type drivers or new private car Uber-type drivers, really is not as important as providing a safe public service at a reasonable price with a decent income for the workers involved. Capitalism doesn't do that very well. It raises workers after a struggle, then invites basically hustler capitalists to come in, undercut the whole arrangement. That leads to suffering and complaints from the public. In come the regulators, up go the wages with some struggle from the workers involved, and you're back to square one, and a new set of capitalists comes in, as I described it. Mr. Salivary's idea deserves some attention. Madison, Wisconsin already has a workers' co-op running their taxi system, and it has been extremely successful for decades. So there's models for doing this, and this might be a way to get out of the absurd cycle and do a better service to the public than the system we have now. I want also to apologize in this next update. I have been given a criticism from listeners in Detroit, and I think they're right, and I think I was wrong. They complained that I was referring to Detroit as an empty wasteland. I hope I didn't use that language, but I might have. And that this didn't give adequate recognition and celebration to the efforts that are being made by all kinds of people in Detroit to offset its decline, to counteract the neglect of that city, to do something positive for the development of that city, at least for those people that are still living there. And I plead guilty. I think I may have overdone it. I was so eager to explain and to show what a tragedy Detroit represents, what a failure of our economic system is staring us in the face every time we look at it, that I overstated the case. I did not mean to disrespect or to deny that there are always efforts, and there are certainly in Detroit these days, of well-meaning people trying in ways large and small to counteract the unjust decimation of that city by an economic system so driven by profits that it will leave a city, no matter how many subsidies it got there, no matter how much the people in that community gave of themselves to help build that industry. And I want to be apologetic that I didn't give enough credit to those that are fighting on the ground to do something against that negative trend. I also want, in the next update, to give a certain recognition, perhaps different than you might hear elsewhere, to the fact that March 8th is International Women's Day, and to tell you a little bit about it and about the economic dimensions of Women's Day. Historically, the first Women's Day observance is thought to have happened on February 28th, 1909. So that's a little bit over 100 years ago. And it was organized by the Socialist Party of America, and it was done in remembrance of the 1908 strike of the International Ladies Garment Workers Union, sometimes known as the shirtwaist factory disaster, where women needed to get out of a factory that was unsafe, where there was a fire, were trapped inside, many died, and it was a kind of a monument to unsafe labor practices, to the demand of working people, often expressed through the Socialist Party, for a better deal. And indeed, the history of the International Women's Day celebration ever since was closely allied to struggles of working people, male and female, to improve particularly the conditions of working women. Another interesting fact is that the beginning of the Russian Revolution in February of 1917 was also associated with a strike in commemoration of Women's Day, so that the intertwining of Women's Day and the struggle for better working conditions and better conditions of life for working people is a part of that holiday that ought to be put front and center, but typically is forgotten, denied, or simply the action, it's as if it had to do with women and not with women and work, which is the real history of the holiday. I also wanted to bring to your attention two interesting developments this last week that in a way speak to the concerns of women of the last 100 years, and particularly those who have built up this international holiday, now recognized by the United Nations as well, of International Women's Day. The first story comes from France, and I find that intriguing. France has passed a new law. The upcoming local elections, which are scheduled for later in the month of March 2015, will be of a new and different kind. When you vote in these local elections, you will automatically vote for two candidates, not one. And the two mean that the people who get the most votes will be a couple, a man and a woman. That is, the law mandates that every job that will now be occupied by two or more people will have to have an equal number of men and women. That everything else the French have done to try to increase the role of women in politics so that they become decision makers, particularly over the economic questions that are so important, their efforts to this date, while better than most countries, still have fallen far short of giving women the 50% that they ought to have because they're 50% of the population. So this is a new and quite radical step. When you vote for an office, you will be voting for two people, one male and one female, and in that way, the winners will always be 50-50 male and winner in the local elections of France. And I thought that's an interesting way of articulating and concretizing a commitment to International Women's Day. And lastly, Kathleen Geyer, a frequent intelligent commentator on economic events, wrote a column last May about a World Bank report in March of 2014. And the point that this report made that I found interesting was to show that when it comes to gender, a rising tide does not lift all boats. In other words, raising the income of a society, the total output, may or may not make a contribution to equalizing the position of men and women. And the report cites Japan, Kuwait, and Qatar as three countries with very high standards of income and production compared to the rest of the world, but places where the inequality between men and women has remained very extreme. It's not enough to concern yourself with GDP and rising output. If you don't deal with the question of equality between men and women directly and explicitly, it won't get solved. Last update that I have time for today is a new report dated March 4th, produced jointly by the website ProPublica and by National Public Radio. Michael Grable from ProPublica and Howard Berkus from National Public Radio. The report is called Demolition of Workers' Comp, and I want to talk to you about that. What is workers' compensation? If a worker gets injured on the job, any sort of injury, here's what happens. The employer, who is required to pay a very small amount, effectively for an insurance policy across the country, state by state, that fund of all the employers paying in constitutes a reserve of money to pay for the costs of curing the injury, overcoming the injury, compensating the worker for the injury. That's what workmen's or workers' compensation means. If you get injured, you get the right to tap into this fund. Now, workers gave something up to get workers' compensation. That's often forgotten. Workers agreed, this is a long time ago, to give up the right to sue a company for causing the injury. In exchange for giving up the right to sue, to be compensated for an injury that the employer is at fault for, the employers who wanted this got workers' compensation. They would pay into a small insurance fund, and that would be where workers go rather than suing their employer. So there was a deal in which workers got an insurance and employers got out from under suits. Okay. Since 2003, this report says, 33 states, an overwhelming majority of states, have cut the benefits or made it more costly for workers to get worker compensation. Wow. And why have the states done this? Their answer, they have to compete with one another for business. So the way the states compete with one another for business is to do something that hurts all workers. It cuts down the benefits they get. It raises the eligibility. It may raise also the fees that the employer has to pay, which will then come out of the bargaining with the employees. I hate to say it, but there is no way out. This is part of the general reduction in the standard of living and the welfare of workers in the United States. You don't hear a great deal about it. Often legislators or governors make these adjustments in workers' compensation and nobody pays much attention. But when you see it building like this over the last group of years, you can finally produce a report like this, and there it stands in a gross example of yet another way that the basic welfare of American working people is being undermined by a capitalist system that is now much more focused on making profits at the top, on moving its production not only from one state to another within the United States, going wherever they get the best deal, no matter what the cost is to the workers, but leaving the country for the same reasons. And the end result is all workers have their standard of living undermined, at least as long as they tolerate this. Okay, I'm now going to turn to questions or responding to questions that you, the listeners, have brought to my attention. The first one has to do with debts, all kinds of debts. And one of you wrote interestingly to me, how you were struck, and I thought this was very wise, that you were struck by the fact that governors, such as Governor Christie, about whose efforts I talked about last week, are cutting pensions. Pensions are a debt that a city or a state has to the workers, a debt because over the years, contracts were bargained with the workers in which the workers did without wage increases or salary increases that they might have otherwise won and accepted instead a pension to be paid in the future. That's a debt of the government that negotiates that kind of contract. And now they're reneging on their debts. They're not going to pay these pensions. They're claiming they have all kinds of economic difficulties, and so they can't pay their debts. And one of you wondered sarcastically, gee, how interesting. It's always the employer who can't pay a pension, whether that employer is public or private, who can't honor their debt. But workers are never in a position to say, well, you know, I'm having economic difficulties. I'm not going to pay my debts. Workers have to go through a very difficult process with many penalties associated called bankruptcy. But short of that, they can't declare, I have some difficulties, so I'm not going to pay my bill to the gas company, my debt to my credit card provider, and so on. So debts, they're in the air these days. I want to talk about debts in a more general way. We hear a lot about Greece, and the Europeans are insisting, led by the Germans, that the Greeks must pay their debts, as if there's some absolute rule that debts have to be paid. There isn't. And I thought that instead of just telling you that every day in every court in the country, and indeed in the world, there are court cases where people who can't pay their debts work out an arrangement with their creditors. There's nothing new or special. And a creditor who simply says, you must pay, is never listened to. Sooner or later, they have to go to court and they have to make a deal. That's how difficult loans are worked out. And to give you examples, here's one that you might not have known about. The United States had a civil war in the 19th century over the questions of slavery and the relationship between the northern and southern states. The Confederacy borrowed a lot of money in Europe to help it pay for the war. So did the Union North. Well, the South lost. And the question was, Europeans said, okay, we lent to a few states in your country. They lost. That doesn't mean they don't owe the debts. They borrowed. They have to pay back. No, said the victorious Union. We're not going to honor the debts of those other states. That's a little bit like a new government in Greece saying we're not going to honor the debts that an old government did because that old government didn't represent us. Rather like the Confederacy didn't represent us. Well, that was fought out, in case you didn't know it, for decades. Only in the 1920s, 70 years after the end of the American Civil War, was it finally resolved that the United States, which insisted on this all the time, would not pay the debts of its Confederate states. And the Europeans lost on that one and had to swallow the loss of their debt. This is not unusual. The other example that I want to remind you about is the Gazette of Germany itself. Both after World War I and again after World War II, Germany found itself unable to pay its debts. After World War I, this was resolved by a series of loans from the United States, where the United States gave money to Germany in big loans, Dawes Plan, Young Plan, they were called. Germany took that money, paid off its debts to England and France, which used that money to pay off their debts to the United States, so the money all came back to New York anyway. From New York to Germany, Germany to Berlin, Germany to Paris and London, Paris and London back to New York. It was a little bit of a game, and it didn't cover all the debts. And eventually, a lot of those debts were canceled. The same thing after World War II in 1953, Germany requested and got a cancellation of most of its debts coming out of World War II. By the way, as interesting commentators have pointed out, during those negotiations, the politicians from the creditor companies didn't say things like they say today, like, our taxpayers are unwilling to forgive any part of the debt. They forgave part of the debt, and they knew very well that their taxpayers were barely paying attention to this question. Now we come to today's struggle between Germany and Greece, and Germany acts as if it's a foregone conclusion that the Greeks must pay all their debts. The history of these sorts of things argues exactly the other way, that large parts of these debts are forgiven. It's purely a political question of the will to do that. And finally, the German taxpayer doesn't want to pay the cost of Greeks not paying their debts. That is really dishonest as a position. There are many problems facing German taxpayers. Those problems could be solved if Germany, for example, taxed their wealthiest people a good bit more than they do today. Germany, like the United States, is experiencing a growing gap between rich and poor. If you wanted to do something about that and tax those at the top, you would relieve the burden of taxation on the middle and lower income people. All kinds of other adjustments could be made in Germany to relieve the pressure on German taxpayers. To keep repeating to German taxpayers that what needs to be done is force the Greek workers to come up with enormous debt payments to the Germans is not fair and is not honest. That is not the only way, that is not a necessary way to relieve the burden of taxation on German workers. To pit the German worker against the Greek worker is to conveniently remove all the other ways that Germany could relieve the burden on its working class from the discussion. That's convenient for the German companies. That's convenient for the German politicians. And that's convenient for the German rich. But it is not an honest way of assessing the burden on German workers on the one hand and the problem of the Greek debt on the other. And it doesn't get at the fact that the Greek debt over the last 30 years generated huge profits to the German, French, and other banks that handled those debts, handled those negotiations. What about that as part of the conversation as well? Well, folks, we've come to the end of the first half of today's program. As usual, there was one of the questions you all asked about how a co-op would work, a workers' co-op, how it would solve certain kinds of problems. As I did last week, let me tease you and promise you that next week's program, the section devoted to listeners' questions, will focus first on the question of how workers' co-ops and worker self-directed enterprises can handle these problems so that it is uppermost. Please stay with me. We will be back in a very short time for the second half of today's program.
I was born in chains.
I was born in chains.
But I was taken out of Egypt.
Taken out of Egypt.
I was bound to a burden.
Bound to a burden.
But the burden, it was raised.
Burden, it was raised.
Lord, I can no longer.
Lord, I can no longer
keep this secret.
This secret.
Blessed is the name.
Is the name. The name.
The name be praised. Fled to the edge of the mighty sea of sorrow, pursued by the riders of a cruel and dark regime. But the waters parted and my soul crossed over out of Egypt, out of Pharaoh's dream. Word of words,
measure of all
measure. Blessed is the name.
The name
be blessed. Written on my heart in burning letters. was idle with my soul when I heard you could use me. I followed very closely, but my life remained the same. But then you showed me where you had been wounded in every atom. Broken is the name. I was alone on the road, and your love was so confusing. All my teachers told me I had myself to blame. But in the grip of sensual illusion, a sweet unknowing, unify the name. Word of words, measure of all measures. Blessed is the name. The name be blessed. Written on my heart in burning letters. That's all I know.
Welcome back, friends, to the second half of Economic Update for this week. Once again, I'm your host, Richard Wolff. Been a professor of economics all my adult life. I teach currently at the New School University in New York City. Later in the program, I will be telling you about the websites and other activities that allow you to pursue interests that are raised in these programs, to get a great deal more material, to communicate with us, and so on. But in the second half of our program, when we either have a person to interview or we deal with major issues, I take you through a more detailed analysis. So I want to begin today's by discussing three examples, different in their ways, of how the current economic crisis that keeps bedeviling us, that isn't in recovery for the vast majority of people, that is producing the extremes of wealth and poverty that we talk about, that produces the use of the money by corporations and the rich, the ones who are becoming wealthier, to buy control of our political system, etc. I want to talk about, as you have asked me to, some of the examples of pushing against that from different parts of society so that no one should be left with the impression that what I describe as happening is some sort of unchangeable, irreversible juggernaut that can't be turned around. It can be, and indeed the only thing that can turn it around, but always has that ability, is the decision of the mass of people to no longer tolerate a system that isn't working for them. So let's give you three examples. I'll go from the mildest to the most remarkable, at least in terms of issues that have come up in the public eye over the last week. My first comment is about Mark Dayton, the current governor of the state of Minnesota. In his term since 2011 to the present, he's done some things that you might not have noticed, and I want you to think about them with me. First, he raised the income tax in the state income tax of Minnesota. He raised the rate from 7.85% to 9.85%. That's a sizable increase. On whom? On individuals earning over $150,000 per year, and on couples earning over $250,000 a year. In other words, he raised the income tax on the rich in his state, generating a new $1.2 billion. What else did he do? He raised the minimum wage, the state-level minimum wage in Minnesota, a series of stages that would make it $9.50 an hour by the year 2018, 3 years from now. Is Mark Dayton a radical trade unionist? Hardly. He's a millionaire, perhaps even a billionaire. He is one of the heirs to the fortune of the Target department store chain. Interestingly, Minnesota boasts a lower unemployment rate than the national average and a higher median income than the national average in the United States. Now, I'm not here to make a silly argument that raising taxes on wealthy people and raising the minimum wage are some guarantee that you'll do well economically. The reason I bring up the Minnesota example is to counter the conservative argument made by Republicans and unfortunately by a great many Democrats too, that somehow raising the minimum wage and taxing the wealthy is a certainty to plunge you into economic disaster. What Minnesota shows is you can do precisely that, tax the rich and help those at the bottom, and you can still come out doing better than most of the other states in the United States. Interesting, modest way to push back against the flow, the trend. And Mr. Dayton is a very popular governor in his state. The second example of pushing back focuses attention on a famous British actress who's also well known in the United States. Her name is Emma Thompson. She's been featured in many films and many television series and so on. She and her husband, Greg Wise, made headlines this last week when they issued a public statement of outrage regarding the HSBC Bank. That bank was caught helping wealthy people around the world through its Swiss offices to avoid taxes in a variety of schemes. What perturbed Emma Thompson and her husband, Greg Wise, was that no official of HSBC was being prosecuted for this, no kind of punishment, and it was too much for them. So they issued a statement saying that they would not pay their income taxes as British citizens unless and until wealthy people were required to pay their taxes, and banks like HSBC were significantly punished for having assisted in enabling wealthy people to escape their taxes. Whatever the outcome here, it was a way of bringing lots of attention on the tax evasion schemes of wealthy people abetted by huge international banks. The third remarkable event last week that shows a certain pushing back, I take from the Reuters news agency, dated February 28th, 2015. And the Reuters dispatch, also picked up by Time magazine, is interesting because it is a report on an audience held by Pope Francis, the relatively new Pope of the Roman Catholic Church, when he met with members of the Confederation of Italian Cooperatives. I'm going to now quote from Pope Francis so that you can hear in his own words what he had to say. Referring to the current economic system, capitalism, here's his sentence, quote, "It seems fatally destined to suffocate hope and increase risks and threats," end of sentence. The Pope condemned what he called, quote, "a throwaway culture created by the powers that control the economic and financial policies of the globalized world," end quote. And he proposed a solution, he did. And the solution Pope Francis proposed was economic cooperatives that would help spread the wealth equally. And now I quote Pope Francis. "Money at the service of life can be managed in the right way by cooperatives, on condition that it is a real cooperative, where capital does not have command over men, but men have command over capital." Wow. The head of one of the largest religions in the world announces himself to be concerned to develop co-ops as against conventional enterprises, because in conventional enterprises, capital has command over men, but in cooperatives, men, I'm sure he means people in general, have control over capital. That is a pushing back against a system that is pretty unambiguous when you think about the consequences. I want to turn next to another major issue. This one, and I guess I'm focusing on the great Midwest of the United States a bit today, has to do not with Minnesota, a Midwestern state, but with neighboring Wisconsin. And I want to tell you a little bit about what's going on there, but also to talk about what it means. The leading caricature or character, depending on your point of view, of the stories coming out of Wisconsin refer to the governor, Scott Walker, a man who's also in the news these days because he's trying to become the Republican candidate for president in the elections scheduled for 2016. Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, got himself into a remarkable bit of hot water over the last several weeks when he proposed initially to cut $300 million from the budget of the University of Wisconsin. The University of Wisconsin is arguably among the five or six leading public universities in the United States, and it's been that for a long time. It is a centerpiece of the cultural and educational life of the state of Wisconsin. It has been a destination for students not only from Wisconsin, but from many other parts of the country, precisely because it is so outstanding. When Scott Walker announced he wanted to cut its budget by $300 million, and let me assure you, if you're not familiar with university budgets, that would be a staggering blow to what that university is able to do in the way of both undergraduate and graduate education. When he was asked to justify it, he said that we don't need economic frills and things like that, and he wanted to make the university produce a better service to local employers. Aha. He wanted there to be a closer relationship between the university on the one hand and the direct worker needs of employers on the other. Well, it has long been understood that one of the beneficiaries of public education are employers, of course. Employers are better off the better educated, the better trained their employees are in and by the public education system. However, no one associated with a major university that I've ever met, and I've been in American major public universities most of my adult life, has ever suggested that that be the basis for what the university does. It's merely one of the several functions that universities perform. Let me list for you several others. Here's one. The job of the university is to allow each citizen who goes to the university to find and to develop his and her skills and potentials to the highest extent possible. That's because enabling people to develop their mental and analytical skills is something we want for our society. That's independent of the job-related benefits. That has to do with the human benefit of being educated. Here's another function. The job of the university is to train people to think about society, to become real citizens, people who care about, who inform themselves about what's going on in the larger community so that they can vote in an intelligent way, so that they can become involved in community and political and cultural events that help shape and make a good society. Let me give you some others. The university is a place that brings people from different parts of the state of Wisconsin together. It enables rural people to meet and interact with and live in the same dormitory as urban people. People engaged in agriculture with those engaged in industry, both of them with those engaged in the production of services. That's right. It allows people from different cultural, religious, family backgrounds to learn what a diverse culture is and how to get the best you can by interacting with, learning from, being friends with people that are different from yourself. The university does that, and it teaches you about the world. This is a governor who has no interest in any of that. He's either driven by a kind of unspoken hostility to everything that education represents, and or he's looking for a way to cut taxes so he can appear to be, to the public, a kind of governor who does that. Or he himself simply doesn't understand what education is for and how important it is. Wisconsin has been a progressive state most of its history, and that's wrapped up with what that university was and still is. This was an assault on the university, and the backlash required that governor to back down, to put away that effort, to cancel it all, while claiming it was all a misunderstanding about the words he used. No misunderstanding, of course. This is happening in many states around the country. And it's part of a general pattern that I want to put on the record now so we all understand what's going on. Businesses across this country see this as their historic moment to lower taxes. They want the United States to make itself more profitable by having lower wages they need to pay their workers, by having lower taxes they need to pay to the government. The unspoken or sometimes spoken threat is, if you don't make it worth our while to stay here, we're leaving. We're going to other states who give us a better deal, or we're going to Mexico or Canada, or we're going to China or India or Brazil. But you either give us more profits here, or we'll go to where the profits are higher. So here's what these politicians do. They begin their political careers by being champions of tax cuts. They promise to the businesses who want to hear it, I'm going to cut your taxes. They promise to the rich who make big contributions to their campaigns, I'm going to cut your taxes. And they promise to the mass of people, vote for me because I'm going to cut your taxes. And at a time of economic trouble, isn't that a nice thing? And they get themselves elected on the basis of these promises. And then they deliver tax cuts for the companies, tax cuts for the rich, and some tax cuts, some crumbs for the masses. Predictably, that means a lot less money coming into the government. So a year or two or three down the road, the same governor announces, we have a fiscal crisis. The government is living beyond its means. Of course the government is living beyond its means, since your tax cut is what reduced the means flowing into the government. But they forget about that part of it. They announce the need now for spending cuts so that the government lives within its means. And then they go about cutting all kinds of government services to people and make a tax on, for example, higher education, such as those of Scott Walker in Wisconsin against the University of Wisconsin, the one I just told you about. And they appeal to the people to support them in cutting services because, after all, you don't want the government living beyond its means. And they threaten that if you don't let them cut services, well, then they'll have to raise taxes, which is a terrible thing to do. As if cutting services isn't a terrible thing to do. But let me drive the point home as sharply as I can. When you cut taxes, there are all kinds of economic effects of that. Rich people have more to spend, corporations have more to spend, and the mass of people, if their taxes are really cut, have more to spend. And that has certain consequences. But when you cut government services to a university, to an environmental protection program, to highway construction, to supporting police and fire services, those things also have economic effects, all kinds of them. And many of those are very negative. No one knows, let me say that again, no one knows in advance whether the positive effects of a tax cut are greater or smaller than the negative effects of the following spending cuts. People who only talk about the tax cut are deceiving you because they're not telling you that you got a problem with these spending cuts. But I'm here to tell you it is often the case, not always, but often, that the spending cuts have a more devastating effect on the economy than the tax reductions ever had in the way of a positive effect. Nor is there much mystery about this. If your tax cuts tilt particularly to wealthy folks and corporations, they are already well off. The extra money in their pockets will likely not be spent. Had the government used that for public services, it means the government would have spent that money. It would have gone into the economy to create demand for goods and services, to create demands for workers who had gotten jobs. By cutting those expenditures, you hurt all those people. And by moving the money instead into the hands of corporations and the rich through tax cuts that favor them, you're putting money in the hands of people who will save rather than spend a good portion of it. That's simple economics and argues that any kind of program that basically takes money out of the hands of the middle and the poor who spend everything they get because they have to and shifts it into the hands of corporations and the rich who don't spend everything they get precisely because they don't have to, that this is prima facie an unwise economic policy. And if so, it asks the question, why would you do an unwise economic policy, unwise for the economy as a whole? And the answer is, we don't have economic policies focused on the people as a whole. That's only verbiage, words. The reality is that we have economic policy to favor those with the power to influence politicians and politics. That's the corporations and the rich. So a tax cut for them is good for them. If they're in the process of leaving the state, leaving the country, making their money elsewhere, which is true of an enormous portion of America's capitalist industry, they really don't care about the consequences socially. They want the advantage now, to have more money, save it from taxes to the country they're leaving, and use it for investments in the other parts of the world to which they are going. That's the reality. That's what's going on in Wisconsin and other states, and it's an important thing to understand about our economic system. We've come to the end of our program. I hope you found it interesting. I want to ask you to make use of the two websites we maintain, rdwolf2fs.com and democracyatwork.info. They are available free of charge 24/7. Not only will you find documentation and examples of the kind of analysis we do on this program, you'll find also a complete archive of all of these programs if you wish to listen to them and many other services. You will also be able to communicate to us your questions, your comments, your criticisms. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter. And we please urge you to use our material in your own tweetings and your own Facebook communications with others so that the work we do can be useful to still more people. I want to thank truthout.org, that remarkable independent source of news and analysis every day, and urge you to check out truthout.org, where you can see the kind of valuable work they do. Finally, I want to appeal to all of you to help and support this work that we do. Make use of these websites. Help them to continue in their work. Spread what we do here. We can make a difference in this society's evolution. The point and purpose of this program is to provide the information and the analysis to help make change come sooner and take a better, more informed form than it otherwise might. You are all an enormous encouragement in your wonderful communications to us for us to continue this work. Let me thank you, but also urge you to make use of what you've learned, to make use of what this program provides. Spread the word. It's part of a collective, cooperative project, all our own. Thank you again for participating and listening. I look forward to talking with you again next week.
Up the road, baby, thing gonna change, baby. Your time now, baby, but after a while, gonna be my time, baby. Thing gonna change, 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 change.